someone, a face that I know is familiar to us all here at ART. Gary is audio engineer at the Crane School of Music at SUNY Potsdam, where he also teaches courses in music literature. Mr. Galo is a widely published author with over 250 articles and reviews to his credit on both musical and technical subjects and over a dozen publications. He has been the sound recording review editor of the ARS Journal since 1995 and was co-chair of the ARS Technical Committee from 1996 to 2004 and is a frequent presenter at ARS conferences. He is also a regular contributor to Audio Express magazine and a frequent book reviewer for Notes, the quarterly journal of the Music Library Association, author of The Loudspeaker Entry in the Encyclopedia of Recorded Sound in the United States, the first edition, and also written for the newsletter, the Wilhelm Furtwängler Society of America, and Toccata, the Journal of the Leopold Stokowski Society. He has handouts. Does everybody have his handouts?
If you don't have a handout, raise your hand.
Can you hear me? Raise your hand.
Okay. Can you all hear me?
Yes.
Good. That's why I moved down here. It's too far away up there. So, okay, we'll get started, except we need my cover sheet here. All right, my presentation today is on the Columbia LP equalization curve. A number of years ago, I began a design work on an archival phono preamp that would have variable bass turnover and variable treble roll-off. I currently have a prototype under construction, which I hope to finish this summer. But in doing the research for the various settings that I needed on that preamp, I ran into a lot of conflicting information on the Columbia LP curve. I did a paper on disc recording equalization at ARSC in 1996, which was published in the fall 96 issue of the ARSC Journal. At that time, I thought I knew what the Columbia curve was, but since that time, I continue to find conflicting information on that. Turns out I did know what it was, but what I needed to do was find a way to verify that what I thought was correct, and that's what this paper is basically about. How many of you are relatively new to the subject of disc recording equalization? Yeah, quite a few people. Okay, a less than 5-minute overview of the subject with a couple of illustrations taken from my 1996 paper. You can download that paper on the internet. It's the first thing listed in the reference if you'd like to read it. It gives you a good overview of the, at least I think a good overview of the workings of disc recording EQ. So, what we have on the bottom here, the solid line, is what is generally known as the recording characteristic in a recording equalization graph. It's sometimes called the recording curve. This graph doesn't look like a curve at all. This rather angular graph is simply a conceptual graph to show where the turnover points are. In reality, the transitions from one point to the next are gradual, so in reality, they actually do look like a curve, but they don't on this conceptual illustration. The bottom here, the solid line, is what we know as the recording characteristic. Up top here, I have an illustration that shows what happens with rising frequency. And you can see the amplitude seems to gradually decrease with rising frequency. And you're probably, if you're new to this subject, wondering, why does the recording characteristic seem to rise with frequency when this illustration on top shows the treble portion lower in amplitude than the bass portion of the audible spectrum on a record? The reason for that is that the so-called recording characteristic or recording curve is actually a graph of recorded velocity. It is not a graph of recorded amplitude. A record is cut with a combination of constant velocity and constant amplitude recording. On a long playing record, up to the low bass turnover, which is F1, the record is cut with a constant velocity characteristic. So the velocity is relatively flat. Between the low bass turnover and the bass turnover, which is F2, it's cut with a constant amplitude characteristic, but the velocity, the speed at which the stylus moves in a given time period, rises with frequency. And so we see a rising characteristic here. We have a constant velocity characteristic between the bass turnover and the treble transition frequencies, F2 and F3, and so the response flattens out. And then above the treble transition frequency, F3, we're back to constant amplitude with velocity rising with frequency. And so the recording characteristic appears to rise. That solid line, which represents recorded velocity, not amplitude as far as what's on the record, becomes an amplitude graph when we play the record back with a velocity-sensitive transducer. In other words, a magnetic phono cartridge, which is a velocity-sensitive device. Play the record back with a magnetic cartridge, and now the solid line is amplitude coming out of that cartridge. Apply the reverse equalization showed by the dashed line, and we get a flat response shown by the dotted line. Brief overview of disc recording EQ. Read the paper for more detailed information. In 1956, the recording industry settled on the RIAA curve, which put the low bass turnover at 50.05 hertz, the bass turnover at 500.5, and the treble transition frequency at 2,122 hertz. Now, the RIAA curve was actually defined not by the turnover frequencies, it was defined by the time constants associated with those frequencies. And time constants are numbers that are absolutely necessary for designing the filters that either produce the recording curves in the first place or produce the appropriate playback curves in your playback preamplifier. But before 1956, before RIAA was standardized, these transition points were all over the place. And when Columbia introduced the long playing record in 1948, they had their own take on it, and that's what this paper is all about. The next slide, and all of these slides are on your handout, by the way. The next slide shows many of the more common conflicting opinions I have found about the Columbia long playing record. Now, I should mention, and I'll say this more than once to avoid confusion, the treble portion of the curve, in other words, the treble transition frequency, F3, is not in dispute. All sources agree on that. And in fact, it's the same as the old NAB curve. What is in dispute and where the varying conflicting opinions come in is on the bass turnover and the low bass turnover, which we sometimes call the low bass shelf. Those are where the differences of opinion lie. Here are some of the more common ones. The manual for the KAB Souvenir preamp, the EQS Mark 12, which I reviewed for Audio Express magazine a number of years ago, it's a very nice preamp. They claim that F1, the low bass turnover, is 50 hertz, the bass turnover at 500. And again, their opinion about the treble roll-off is no different from anyone else's, that the treble roll-off begins at 1590 hertz, which gives us plus 16 dB in record at 10 kilohertz or minus 16 dB in playback at 10 kilohertz. KAB also notes that they put a low frequency gain stop in to produce the correct curve, and my measurements indicated that they did do that. Some sources give turnover frequencies, others give time constants. And what I've given on this sheet is however the source listed it. If they listed frequency, that's what I give. If they listed time constants, I give that instead and put the corresponding information in parentheses. And whether it's plus or minus 16 dB at 10 kilohertz has to do with whether it's you're talking about the recording curve or the playback curve. The recording curve, it's plus. If it's the complementary curve needed in playback, it's minus. Howard Tremain, who many remember from the old Audio Cyclopedia, said the Columbia turnover frequency, bass turnover frequency, F2, was 300 hertz. He didn't specify the other two transition points. The late Peter Copeland, the well-known English sound archivist, expressed his frustration at the fact that he could never find any official statement about the Columbia recording curve. However, his interpretation of a published graph was that the low bass turnover was set at 100 hertz. He gave a time constant number there of 1590 hertz. You want to convert frequency to time constant or vice versa. I've given the formula up there, but I'm not going to talk about it because most of you don't need to know that. He gave the bass turnover at 398 hertz or 400 microsecond time constant. Again, his opinion about the treble roll-off is the same as everybody else's. That is not in dispute. He also looked at a graph in the very famous Fritz Langford Smith book called The Radiotron Designer's Handbook. There's a whole chapter in there on disc recording. And he said his interpretation of Langford Smith's graph is that the base turnover frequency is actually 350 microsecond time constant, corresponding to a frequency of 455 hertz. So Copeland offered two different possible interpretations of the Columbia LP curve. One based on how he felt it probably was, and the other one, his interpretation of Langford Smith's graph. If you've ever looked at Langford Smith's graph, it's hard to decipher anything from it. Macintosh, their famous C8 preamplifier, which had five different bass roll-off switches and five different treble roll-offs, or five different bass turnover switches and five different treble roll-off switches, which in various combinations could dial up 32 different bass turnover frequencies and 32 different treble roll-off rates. Macintosh had a very famous equalization chart, which they supplied with that preamplifier. And their equalization chart, they do not specify F1, the low bass shelf or low bass turnover, but they say to set F2, the bass turnover, to 750 hertz, which seems rather odd. But they also say that the bass control has to be set to -2. So you look at the Macintosh chart, you can't take that 750 hertz number by itself very literally, because there was also an adjustment needed with the bass control in order to produce the correct result. Again, no disagreement about F3, the treble transition point or the treble roll-off. Jim Powell, High Fidelity Magazine, the manual to RecoCut Esoteric Sounds Re-Equalizer, and many other sources say that F2 is 500 hertz. They note parenthetically that it's a modified NAB bass turnover. Again, same information for the treble roll-off. They don't specify F1, and that's part of the confusion here. John Ergel and a number of others elaborate on Powell, High Fidelity Magazine, and so forth by getting specific about that low bass shelf, and they put it at 100 hertz. So those are seven conflicting opinions about the Columbia LP curve. Well, what to do about this? In 1949, the inventors of the Columbia LP record, Peter Goldmark, Rene Snepfanger, the unsung hero of the Columbia LP, and William S. Bachman, published an article on the Columbia LP record in the Proceedings of the IRE. And in that article, they gave a graph that showed the recording curve, the recording characteristic. But as Peter Copeland noted in frustration, they supplied no data with that graph. No time constants, no turnover frequencies. One was supposed to look at this graph and figure out where the three transition or turnover frequencies were supposed to be, which is very difficult to do. They also note that the Columbia LP curve was derived from the NAB curve. And the top portion of the curve, number one, below 200 hertz, is the Columbia recording characteristic. And in a dashed line below that, they have the NAB curve, and you can see how it differs from the Columbia, at least in a rough sense. I'd like to say one thing about this graph. Note that the 0 dB reference has been put at 1,000 cycles per second, as they used to say in 1949, at 1 kilohertz, which is very common for frequency response graphs. They put the 0 dB reference there, which is typical. Again, high frequency portion of the curve not in dispute. It's in the base region that we have to figure out what is going on here. Well, I deciphered this graph, which I will refer to as the Snepfanger's graph for the rest of this presentation. And you'll notice I seem to have gotten information off this graph in the base region that's accurate, or at least has resolution out to 1/100 of a decibel, and you're probably wondering, how could I possibly get resolution to 1/100 of a dB looking at this graph? Well, you can't by simply looking at it. What I did is I borrowed from a friend of mine a set of dial calipers with resolution to 1/1000 of an inch, and I very carefully measured this graph. I determined the distance for 10 dB, divided that by 10 to get the distance for 1 dB, and then I measured key points along this graph to get the data. And that's where all the data comes from that we'll see in the subsequent slides. Now, for many years, I've designed a number of phono preamplifiers, including several for RIAA equalization, and I have been using a simulation model to generate an RI, a mathematically exact RIAA recording characteristic, so on my computer, I can check the accuracy of an RIAA phono preamplifier design before I actually build it. Well, it was no big deal to simply change that model and plug in the appropriate math to change the component values to generate any recording characteristic I chose to do. And I decided to generate recording curves based on the varying opinions about the Columbia curve and see how closely they matched up to Snapmongers to try and determine where those turnover points really were. I'm not going to go into the math for the simulation model. For those of you who have electronics background, you can look at that on your own, but we don't need to get bogged down in that here. But that's how I did it. I generated recording curves in computer simulations. This next slide, just by way of some clarification here, it's a little confusing about the treble roll-off in recording curves, or the treble boost as it would be in record. There are actually three different ways to specify it, and they all mean the same thing. We can specify it the first way, which is plus the number of dB up we are in record, or minus the number of decibels down we are in playback at a frequency of 10 kilohertz. And you'll often read, for example, that RIAA is at minus 13.73 dB in playback at 10 kilohertz. That's one way to do it. We can also specify the actual transition frequency, which is where the roll-off begins. It's actually the 3 decibel point, plus in record, minus in playback. The transition frequency will be considerably lower than where we're at, or considerably different than where we're at 10 kilohertz. We can also specify the time constant associated with the transition frequency. And that's a number we need to either generate recording curves or design a preamp in playback. So all three of these pieces of information give us the same thing. The Columbia treble roll-off, which is not in dispute, again, the treble everybody agrees on, in playback, we are at minus 16 dB at 10 kilohertz, which corresponds to a time constant of roughly 1,590 microseconds, or 1,590 hertz, excuse me, a time constant of 100 microseconds. So three ways of expressing the treble roll-off, all of which mean the same thing, and different authors have different opinions about how to do it. I give a formula on the previous page for converting negative dB at 10 kilohertz to the actual transition frequency. I have a spreadsheet I did that does that math, because I don't much like math. So I try to make it easy on myself. But we don't need to let that detain us any further. So, I ran a bunch of simulations on using varying opinions on the Columbia curve. Three things on each of these slides. We have the original Snapmongers graph on top. We have the graph generated by my computer simulation on the bottom. And at the very bottom, we have the measurements I took off the Snapmongers graph, the measurements that I got from this simulation, and the difference between them, the error. I started with Howard Tremaine, Audio Cyclopedia. He said the bass turnover was 300 hertz. I put the low bass shelf in at 30 hertz because he didn't specify where he thought it ought to be and got substantial errors in the low frequency. So we can discount Howard Tremaine altogether. It doesn't line up. It's just absolutely not right. And if you change the low bass shelf from 30 to, say, 50 or 100, it doesn't fix the problem. It just changes the errors. So that one's no good. Next. 50 hertz, 500, and 1590, another popular combination. The errors are still way out of line in the low frequencies, so we can discount that one entirely. Moving on to one of Peter Copeland's interpretations, where the bass turnover is a time constant of 400 microseconds, a turnover frequency of 398 hertz. The errors are roughly a dB and a half, dB and three quarters. I mean, we're getting in the ballpark, but it still isn't right on. That's pretty sloppy. So I don't think that one's right. Next, Copeland's interpretation of the graph in the Fritz Langford Smith book. As Bullwinkle said when he pulled Rocky out of the hat, he said, well, I'm getting close. And we are getting close here, in fact. The errors are less than a decibel. And probably if you played a Columbia LP back with this curve, most people probably wouldn't complain too much. But that still wasn't quite good enough for me. So I ran one more based on the last opinion I gave, where we have 100 hertz low bass shelf, 500 hertz turnover, and a 1590 hertz treble transition frequency. And as you can see, that one nails it. The worst errors are a little over a quarter dB. That convinced me that that was the Columbia recording characteristic, and none of the other opinions were there. We're quite right. I also did some measurements on the NAB portion, the bottom portion of Snepbanger's graph, and I ran some simulations to try to match it. And the one that I found matched the closest was by simply dropping the low bass shelf to 50 hertz. And that made a graph that matched Snepbanger's NAB curve pretty closely. And in the next slide, very quickly, you can see what the errors are. They're pretty small for a 50 hertz low bass shelf for NAB, less than a decibel. And I put in a couple of other low bass shelf numbers in for NAB, a couple of other popular opinions that have floated around, and found that the errors were higher. But what I really wanted to do is investigate the NAB curve a little bit closer to try and see what was really going on with the NAB curve. And so I did. And I got the dial calipers out again and measured the NAB graph very, very carefully and ran some simulations. This is the NAB curve as published by NAB in April 1949 and reproduced by Oliver Reed in his book, The Recording of Reproduction and Reproduction of Sound, on page 242. The NAB curve, this graph has confused a lot of people. And the reason it has confused a lot of people is because NAB chose to put the 0 dB crossing, the 0 dB reference, at a frequency of 700 hertz rather than 1 kilohertz. And frequently, you will read in various sources about the NAB treble roll-off, it will say minus 16 dB for playback at 10 kilohertz, and then parenthetically, it will say 0 dB reference is 700 hertz, as if somehow this minus 16 dB at 10K is different from the Columbia minus 16 dB at 10K. It's caused a lot of confusion. I'm going to talk about why it shouldn't matter momentarily. But I ran some simulations, and the one I thought lined up quite closely with the NAB graph was using Snepbanger's interpretation of NAB, where the low bass shelf is 50 hertz, the rest of it's the same as Columbia. And we got a graph here that looks very much like the NAB graph up there, but very much like is not quite good enough, so I decided to run some circuit simulations to try and nail it down. One other point about the NAB graph, you'll notice that the NAB graph says that the tolerance is plus or minus 2 decibels. That's pretty sloppy, particularly these days with not much effort. We can design RIAA equalization networks, for example, that are accurate within a few thousandths of a decibel. By today's standards, that plus or minus 2 dB seems very sloppy. What I want to talk about now momentarily is just exactly what does plus 16 dB or minus 16 dB at 10 kilohertz, what does it mean? And that brings us to the next slide. In order to understand what that specification means, what that number means, we have to look at the high frequency portion of the curve by itself. Get rid of the bass and just run a simulation on the high frequency portion of the curve and see what we've got. This is a simulation using the Columbia and NAB treble characteristic by itself. You will note the following. Plus 16 dB at 10 kilohertz, which indeed this graph is, here's our 0 dB reference, is relative to the low end of the audio spectrum. For you engineers out there, it's really relative to DC, but 20 hertz is close enough because it'll produce the same result. It's not relative to 1 kilohertz. When you take a time constant of 100 microseconds and you plug it into the formula for generating the component values, it's relative to DC, or say 20 hertz. It's not relative to 1 kilohertz. All 1 kilohertz is a convenient reference point that is used on most graphs. You will note on this graph that 1 kilohertz is approximately 1.5 dB up already relative to 20 hertz, or to the bottom end of the spectrum, which means that the difference between 10K and 1K is only about 14.5 dB. So it's not plus 16 relative to 1K. Also, when you combine this filter with the bass portion of the curve and you adjust the position of your curve so the 0 dB reference is at, say, 1 kilohertz, 10K will normally not appear at exactly plus 16 dB on your graph. Okay? Not when you throw the base portion in with it to generate the complete curve and then move your reference to your 0 dB reference to 1K. It won't. So you've got to look at the treble portion of the curve by itself in order to understand what that number really means, and that's what this graph is all about. My educated guess, NAB moved the 0 dB reference to 700 Hertz to put 10 kilohertz at plus 16 dB on the graph, which is exactly what happens on this graph. Furthermore, which I didn't note on the slide or the handout, moving the 0 dB reference to 700 Hertz actually puts the 0 dB reference midway between the extremes of the graph, because the bottom end, and NAB only goes down to 50 Hertz, the bottom end is at approximately minus 16 dB, not quite there, but pretty close, and the top end is at plus. It was a totally practical decision on NAB's part to put it in the middle of the extremes of the curve, and in fact it does put 10K at plus 16. But remember what I said about what that really means. So I ran some computer simulations on varying opinions of the NAB curve to try to nail it down. And Peter Copeland gives his opinion of the NAB curve, where the low base shelf is at 70.7, the base turnover at 578.7, the treble roll-off, again, we already know what it is because there's no dispute about that. And then I took the data I got off the Snepfanger's graph, then I ran a couple of other simulations using two other opinions that I've read about the low base shelf, and these are the results. Let's start with 3 and 4. Which are these combinations of time constants and or turnover frequencies. We'll start with 3 and 4. In the base region, you'll notice the errors are greater than 2 dB. They are outside the stated tolerance of the NAB graph, so we can throw those out. 3 and 4 are no good. Peter Copeland is well within the 2 dB tolerance, so it's certainly acceptable. However, when I took what I got from Snepfanger's interpretation of NAB and plugged 50 Hertz, 500, and 1590 into the simulation, I get number 2 here, where the errors are even smaller than Copeland's. Copeland's average error is about 9/10 of a dB. The average error I get with the simulation I ran using Snepfanger's data is about 7/10 of a dB. And again, this column over here is the data I got by carefully measuring the NAB graph with the dial calipers. As far as I'm concerned, number 2, 50, 500, and 1590, that's the NAB curve. That's the closest I came in simulation. Now, when did Columbia get rid of the old curve and begin using RIAA? This is kind of a thorny question. In the early to mid-50s, High Fidelity magazine published a chart every month called Dialing Your Discs in the Recording Review section of the magazine, in which they gave settings for various LPs that were available, that were being reviewed in the magazine. In September 1955, they note that their recommendation for Columbia is still the original Columbia LP curve. But if you look at the asterisk and read the fine print down below, they note that beginning sometime in 1954, records made from new masters require RIAA equalization for bass and treble. If you go to the next issue, October 1955, their recommendation for Columbia is now RIAA. I realize you can't see that, but it's on the handout. But again, an asterisk to fine print down below says they are currently re-recording old masters for the RIAA curve. So sometime late 1954, 1955, they were making the transition. Can you tell by the labels? Well, not exactly. This is the original Columbia LP label, at least the classical Masterworks label. They use other colors, including green for light classical fare and red and gray for popular. White, by the way, was used for promotional records and on both for both classical and popular releases. But according to Mike Stosich of Esoteric Sound, he gives a cutoff point by matrix and catalog number. And he says matrix number XLP3200 is the last record cut with the old curve. I've recently got some more data from the Columbia archive from Dennis Rooney, which I'm mulling over. And when I publish this in the fall issue of the journal, hopefully, I'm going to include that data as well. So this is one person's opinion as to where the cutoff point is. It's not cast in stone. In 1955, Columbia switched to the very famous Six Eyes label. I thought that all of them should be RIAA. However, there may be some early LPs with the Six Eyes label that in fact follow the old Columbia curve. Most of them are RIAA, but there may be a few holdovers that were not remastered yet when they started sticking these labels on them. So that's a point of confusion. Conclusions. The Columbia LP curve used time constants of 1590 microseconds, 318 microseconds, and 100 microseconds, corresponding to turnover frequencies of 100 hertz, 500 hertz, and 1590 hertz, that latter number meaning the same thing as plus or minus 16 dB at 10 kilohertz, whether you're talking about the record boost or the playback roll-off. Conclusion number two, the closest fit to the published NAB graph is 3180 microseconds, 318, and 100, corresponding to turnover frequencies of 50 hertz, 500, and 1590. The only difference between the NAB curve and the Columbia curve is the low base turnover point, F1. Columbia put it at 100 hertz. NAB, according to my simulations, put it down around 50 hertz. So yes, the Columbia LP curve is a modified NAB. The modification is in the change of the low base shelf and nothing more. And NAB's decision to put the 0 dB reference at 700 hertz rather than 1 kilohertz is irrelevant. The plus or minus 16 dB at 10K on an NAB graph really doesn't mean anything different than it does on other graphs, once you understand what that means. And so those are my conclusions, and that's it. I would welcome anyone who has information, not somebody else's interpretation of a graph, but information from the Columbia vaults or from NAB that specifies the time constants or the turnover frequencies. I'd love to find it.
Take a couple of questions while we do a little technology song and dance here.
Jay?
Okay, Gary, if I'm not mistaken, Columbia had record players manufactured during this period. Have you looked at their circuit diagrams?
No, I haven't, because I haven't looked at the circuit diagrams, but I know some people have actually measured some old preamplifiers. The problem with doing that is that component tolerances, the tolerances that generated these curves in, say, 1948, 1950, the tolerances on the components that generated the curves were probably 10% on a good day. So the measurements you might get by measuring an old piece of equipment are probably not going to be very precise.
All right, but how about just looking at the circuit diagrams?
I haven't looked at the circuit diagrams. I have not seen that. Yes?
Yeah, and I continue to trust my base turnover settings on the old LM1 with RIAA.
So you use RIAA for Columbia in the base region? According to the Snepfanger's graph, it's not right. I mean, I'm not...
Tom Owen said to do 750, and that was a compromise.
Tom Owen said to do 750, and that was a compromise, yeah. Which is actually what McIntosh said. Steve?
Cook Records issued a test record that had the Columbia curve on it.
Mm-hmm.
Did you measure that?
No, I didn't. I did not.
Okay, that might be another way.
That might be, yeah. I took Snepfanger's, Bachmann, and Goldmark at their word that the graph they published was correct, and what I tried to do is run computer simulations to duplicate their graph.
But you do have another.
I agree. Yes.
Just a quick comment. You referred to Peter Copeland's research, and some of you might know that Peter was working on a manual in the closing years of his life of analog transfer techniques. That manual is going to be published online in May.
You're saying Copeland has published that?
His manual was never finished. At the time he died, he never quite
finished. I'd be interested in seeing that data.
Well, the British Library is going to publish it all freely online in May.
Okay. If you could email that to me, I'd appreciate it. Great. Or come up and see, we will talk afterwards. Yes?
Any chance you did any EQ work on wire recorders?
No, not on wire recorders. Nope. That's another subject entirely. So much to do, so little time. Yes?
Another booby trap in both magnetic recording and disc recording is that people tend to talk in terms of preamplifier equals electronic equalization curves. And of course, the standards are not for that. Therefore, the groove velocity or the tape flux and the heads and arms and such in the phonograph have a response of their own that adds to the preamp.
Right. When we look at a recording curve, as I mentioned at the beginning of this presentation, we are actually looking at a graph of recorded velocity. And when a manufacturer designed a cutter head to cut an old record, they took a lot of other things into consideration other than just the resistor and capacitor networks to generate those curves. They had to take into account the inductance of the cutter head, mechanical characteristics of the cutter, and so forth to produce the ultimate curve. But once again, I believe Snepfongers, Bachmann, and Goldmark, when they published that curve, I think their published curve, I have no reason to believe their published curve was wrong. And my attempt was to duplicate the curve that they published. Yes?
Yeah, there was some discussion earlier this week about the mastering engineers doing a certain amount of undocumented during the mastering process, and I wonder whether you've done anything to determine the consistency of the curve within the Columbia catalog, whether there's any.
In other words, was the curve consistent from one year to the next?
Or from one LP to the next?
You seem to think that it might not have been, right?
Oh, it's definitely varied. There was no adherence to any standard, except insofar as there were published standards.
Right.
Every engineer customized his product depending upon the material that he was mastering.
There's another point I'd like to make, and then we're probably going to have to wrap up here. There are other things that affect the tonal balance of a record other than just the recording characteristic. It has always been my view that the recording characteristic is the characteristic of the disc cutting apparatus and its associated electronics. Microphone response, the engineer adding some post-production equalization while the record's being cut and like that, certainly affect the tonal balance of the record. I think they are not to be confused with the actual recording characteristic of the record.
Well, on that note...
that's Buell the buzzer. My time is up. Thank you very much.